Welcome back to Discursion, Season 2, Episode 9. Just a quick disclaimer before the start. I do apologise for my audio quality during this recording. We've just started using Zoom and we're still getting a hang of the settings. Enjoy the show! Welcome back to Discursion. Podcast after a season break. This time we're going to be doing a mini-series of neo-noir, starting with London Silver Lake, with your hosts Stephen.
And Dominic.
We're doing a sort of mini-series. So traditionally we've tended to pick films that have recently been issued on Blu-ray and DVD that we've been collecting. But because of this lockdown period, I've been tend to see some films that have been released on streaming, some more recent films that maybe had a sort of digital premiere. And it seems to have a bit more of a buzz about them because people aren't going to the cinema, so streaming seems to be even more prominent than it was.
Yeah.
So we've chosen to do a mini-series on neo-noir. And since I can't go to my favourite cinema, The Watershed, at the moment, so...
I know, sob.
This is as close as I get, really, seeing these film festival releases on movie. This week we're going to be focusing on... what's it called, Dominic?
Under the Silver Lake.
Exactly.
David Robert Mitchell's 2018 or 2017. It seems to be listed as 18, but I think at the end of the film the credits say 17. So anyway.
It's possible that we have a sort of a Sundance print being released on the movie streaming site or something, which might have confused between general release and sort of festival release. I suppose it's worth mentioning that David Robert Mitchell he's not the David Mitchell that we know in Britain.
Well, he's not either of the David Mitchells, right? It's terribly confusing. Yeah. There's David Mitchell, the comedian, David Mitchell, the novelist.
Neither of those. He's an American director. This is his third film. So his breakthrough, well, not his breakthrough, his debut was The Myth of the American Sleepover, which is like a teen coming-of-age film in the style of Graffiti and Dazed and Confused, which I haven't seen.
No, I was going to ask you that. Yeah, I haven't seen it either.
But it seems to be referenced indirectly this film because the main character, Sam, played by Andrew Garfield, goes to Cinespia, which is the Hollywood Cemetery Cinema, and sees a team and later meets the actresses from that movie. Mm. And then after his debut, he did have what you might call a breakthrough film with It Follows, which garnered more attention in the mainstream as a horror film.
It's quite an interesting first three. At the top of my head, it strikes me as quite unusual to have three. I was going to say three first films. I don't mean that. One's first three films. They're all generically really quite distinct. You know, I think that's. I'm sure it's not unheard of. It's quite unusual.
Yeah,
I would say.
I suppose under Silver Lake is in the tradition of Hitchcockian sort of mystery and the whole LA noir strand of film noir. You know, you've got things.
Yeah,
like,
sort of. It's kind of
confidential.
I feel it's more in the strand of, like, specifically, it's in the strand of the Hitchcockian mystery, as in. It's in the strand of the films which are supposedly like Hitchcock, which in a sense aren't really like Hitchcock, rather than it actually being like a Hitchcock film, if that's not too convoluted.
You mean like it's like a Brian De Palma or something?
I would put it in the tradition of those films which are talked about as having something Hitchcockian about, rather than thinking that the most illuminating thing would be to, you know, directly compare it to Hitchcock. That's my reaction.
Yeah.
It sort of doesn't seem like it's very like Hitchcock at all to me, but I understand that the adjective Hitchcockian is not unhelpful, you know.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's unhelpful. It's not consistently like a Hitchcock film, but there are sequences which just scream of vertigo.
Yeah.
And the score in parts is very much like Bernard Herrmann's score, which you might get in a Hitchcock 50s film.
Yeah.
The plot itself is quite straightforward. If you see the film a couple of times, essentially man links together a series of clues and finds a secret underground bunker bought by the wealthy in order for them to supposedly transcend the human realm after death. And this is the series. And this is happening while he's also hunting down the girl that he fancies. But the film has all sorts of stumble blocks that might get in the way on a first viewing, especially if you see it at a festival with a bunch of other films. It can seem, on the surface at least, to be quite cryptic. There are parts which seem sexually problematic. And you could be more or less sympathetic to the film on those grounds.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me as it's ultimately a sort of Shaggy Dog story, isn't it? That's what I, which, and even though we have all these indications of his sort of obsessive, you know, all these familiar themes of kind of paranoid delusion and searching for secret mysteries, it sort of takes on the rhythm that one led to expect that something will actually kind of come of all this. And the fact that it doesn't, I feel is in retrospect sort of perfectly predictable. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, but as in that's obviously the kind of thing that the film is doing, but nonetheless not unreasonably, right? For lots of people, perhaps that's not a terribly satisfying thing to get from a film, is to sort of have a whole load of mystery sort of, or sense of mystery sort of built up and created, and then to have it kind of dissipated and sort of pissed away. Seems to be like the film sort of going wrong. But I think if you have that sense, I don't think you've misunderstood the film. I think that is sort of what it's doing.
Because Sam goes hunting these clues, hoping to track down this girl and maybe to find some kind of higher truth, which is sort of what we're used to from narrative, you know, films, that there will be some problem that is solved, or in film noir there will be some mystery uncovered, or the character will you know, reveal something about their past. But in this case, he gets to the end point. It's essentially laughed at for pursuing all of these clues, has been told by one of the masterminds, the songwriter, that he's wasting his life. There's nothing here for him to find. And also by one of the mega rich characters who wants to be entombed in the caves that Sam discovers, that your life is just a series of small sort of kicks of small rewards. We're getting very small rewards. That there is a higher sort of purpose that we are looking for, that you will not be sort of privy to. In other words, the whole sort of process of looking at these clues, and also the materials of the clues, belong to comic book materials, serials, packets, adverts, that are part of mass culture, are also being sort of criticised. It's quite vapid.
I think the film... I mean, this strikes me, I mean, it's sort of quite familiar territory, and there are various other, definitely Thomas Pynchon, you know, the novels of Thomas Pynchon is clearly something that's very much behind this. Although I found the first time I watched it, I found it more sort of effectively Pynchonian. I actually found that slightly, found it slightly less effective the second time. But I think that's clearly sort of something that it's going for. But yeah, it sets up this, I mean, I think sort of gives you a quite clear sense that the way that Sam is looking for meaning is not how meaning works. But then the film still sort of traps you into hoping that it will have the kind of meaning that he's looking for. But
it's something we think about quite a lot on the podcast, what films feel like on second or repeat viewing. This film is a special case, but because it is a kind of a puzzle film, and there's a whole group of people on the internet who are trying to crack this film and look for clues beyond,
yes,
which, you know, beyond those exposed in the narrative, you know, just parts of the decor and the film, like markings on walls, people are trying to decode. And so obviously getting pleasure from a repeat view. But is it possible that it will sort of some of the film's weaknesses appear on second viewing? Some of that mystery falls away, doesn't it?
Well, it's rather interesting. Well, I don't know. I had that feeling, and then I'm now wanting to stop myself again, assuming that I know what kind of film it is, because I think you're right that it's actually not really that confusing. It's a little bit confusing the first time, but particularly the second time, it's actually quite linear and it's got a relatively slow sort of pace. So I kind of, my first instinct is to say it's not confusing enough, because that's one of the things, particularly about this kind of Pynchonian tone that, you know, if you're reading one of his well, you know, the one of his novels, you know, V or Gravity's Rainbow or something, there's this sense that there's so much there that it's you're never completely lost, but it's you're teetering on the edge, and it's on the edge of comprehensibility, or just, you know, or sort of followability. And there's always that sense in Pynchon, there's sort of both. There's the paranoia and there's the anti-paranoia. So, you know, there's the paranoia that everything is connected, which is sort of a way terrifying, but also at least sort of is giving you a grasp on how the world works. But then there's the sort of equal and opposite fear that nothing is connected.
I'm reminded of an old professor of mine teaching postmodern lit, who said, my students often say they can't follow this, and this might have been in relation to Pynchon. They can't follow this. It's too disconnected. And he said, actually, it's hyperconnected. But it might feel there might be a disconnect with you, because you're being given more information than you can sort of digest. Sort of scrambling around trying to link all of these motifs that keep appearing, which does a good job of putting you in the frame of mind of sound and film, that these images which keep flashing and appearing throughout. But the film is quite locked down in terms of an image or a phrase will return later, and it will lead to a sort of linear outcome, which is this
of the
tomb in the hills, and beyond that it's more of sort of an epilogue, sort of explaining what his tomb is for. There are other mysteries, of course, that you can try and solve, if you like the parrot. His name is Parrot, which is screeching.
What do you think the parrot is saying? Some people have said he's saying Hollywood. There are bits at the end where it really sounds to me like he's saying Oliver, but there are other bits where
I wonder if it's a red herring.
Yeah, I think it probably is. But I do. So I do almost have that feeling that I wanted it to be more confusing. I sort of feel, or at least, I mean, not really necessarily sort of complicated in the plot, you know, but the sort of texture of bewilderment that I feel it's clearly trying to generate, and which I kind of felt the first time and was fairly enjoyable, but was actually second time it felt less intense, you know. And those films which do that sort of thing and really work, you know, whether they're, you know, whatever, Mulholland Drive or, you know, there is a specific tradition of, you know, bewildering noirs in LA, right? I mean, the sort of, like, probably the most famously confusing sort of classic noir is The Big Sleep, right? Has that. I mean, which is perhaps a little bit overstated, but there's the anecdote which is always told of Howard Hawks not, you know, while shooting it, being puzzled about who killed a particular character, and actually phoning Raymond Chandler, and Raymond Chandler saying he had no idea, even though he'd written the novel. So, you know, that sort of sense of following the plot of a murder mystery itself being a red herring, because it's about the texture of the experience and the characters and that kind of thing. And then that seems to, I mean, lots of noirs are confusing, but that seems to be, or at least it's sort of become, it seems to me to have come to sort of stand for that. And it seems somehow significant. I mean, whether it's just accidental or that the fact that it's an L that's an LA film, not a New York film. You know, the sort of confusions in New York seem to be different, right? There's
Usefully foreshadowing our next episode.
Well, you'll try and,
But
do you
I
know what I mean,
think,
though? That yeah,
yes,
there's
you,
something
this.
about, you know, and you get it in people like Mike Davis's book about, you know, about LA. I think there's that kind of something specifically bewildering about LA with the way certain things bump up against each other in a kind of incomprehensible way, or at least so say some people. I mean, I think lots of LA residents also get very angry with this kind of thing because they think it's a fairly stupid picture of LA. But anyway, there does seem to be that, you know, tradition, and then this film, and then of course, The Big Lebowski absolutely inhabits that same thing in a comic, you know, combining it with being stoned, which is sort of part of the same experience. And this is another one in that tradition. It doesn't do the thing which you get in. Well, you get in The Big Lebowski, and you get in Inherent Vice, which of course is, yeah, actually, you know, a Pynchon novel doing this kind of thing. The particular kind of deflation where a whole bunch of absolutely crucial, you know, paranoid conspiracy theory sort of solutions are shown to be simply coincidences or, you know, misinterpretations. Kind of, he's wrong about the fact that the girl is dead, but he's right that something strange is going on and there is a mysterious conspiracy, and it's not left ambiguous. He does kind of find a load of stuff out, you know, which means it actually, yeah, sort of, when you get to the end of the film, it has less of that phantasmagoric kind of what was real, what was not real, in a sense, because even if he can't do anything with it, he has found a whole bunch of stuff out.
Yeah, he has, and he's an amateur sleuth, but he also is very successful, admittedly, and finds out, you know, there's a whole secret world there in Hollywood Hills, but it's fueled by paranoia. Whereas, you know, in a classic film noir, you might have a character who is maybe somewhat scarred and very good at detective work because they are always on the alert, because of some past trauma, because someone is chasing them. Here, Sam is just sort of overwhelmed by pop culture and starts to see signs in it. And then, of course, the key ingredient is psychedelic drugs. There is also fuel and the Silver Lake can allow for little sort of vision, some imaginative
But again,
skips.
that's something, yeah, that seems to be a familiar, you know, again, there's always the bit in the noir where the detective gets you know, either beaten up or gets sort of, you know, force-fed alcohol. Well, as happens in North by Northwest, as well, you know, but and there's that sort of thing, and then it gets turned in the 70s into acid and part of that. But yes, and this happens in this when he eats the entire, you know, LSD spiked biscuit. But
Yeah, is he more in
yeah,
that category of, he's sort of a Jimmy Stewart character, and he's like an everyday guy that gets caught in a strange situation, but he's also got that kind of maniacal craziness to him that makes him a good detective.
I sort of feel, in a way, what's most interesting. I did have the feeling again watching it yesterday that yes, a slight bit of disappointment, and there were a certain amount of things which just seemed to be over familiar. You know, I mean, sort of structurally, or like we know how these kind of things work, and particularly, I couldn't like the. This whole these all these themes that it's working with about conspiracy and paranoia, sort of given that they've been so charged in the Trump era, and the fact that perhaps I was missing things, but I couldn't sort of see that was being dealt with kind of, you know, at all. That seemed to be a missed opportunity or an evasion. I wasn't quite sure, as much as certain things in it are entertaining, I wasn't quite sure what it was doing that was different. And I think in some ways what I did think though, and I'd not I think the most interesting thing, which I think is quite different and not quite sure how to, you know, what to do with it, is quite how unpleasant Sam is.
Yes.
I mean, you know, he finds some kids, sort of 12-year-old kids early on who keyed his car, and they're kind of keying, you know, other cars down the street, and you know, one of them's pissing on one, and he like severely beats up two of them, you know. And
Yes.
that's sort of put in as quite, you know, sort of beat quite early in the film, where this guy who you think is a sort of comic loser is something quite different, and you start to laugh because the violence is a little bit excessive, and then I think you sort of stop laughing. You're like, oh, this is, yeah.
Yeah, he has an edge to him, for sure.
You know, he's sort of sociopathic or something, or I don't know. There is something sort of deeply, and I think that is quite interesting. That is quite. I'm sure there are connections one can trace, and of course, there's that in certain of the detectives and things. But that, I think, perhaps that's what I find the most unusual about this film. But I'm not quite sure I know yet what to do with it, or whether the film quite makes the most of it. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know, does that tally at all with your experience, or have we watched, you know, two very different films?
I found it problematic because on the one hand, he seemed to be someone who was just absorbing so much, so full of pop culture. Some of it, which I love, the references to Nintendo Mario, you know, and Nirvana, of course.
Yeah.
So I kind of understand that obsessive behavior and that sort of collector's behavior in the comic books as well. But it also becomes that sort of obsession over details becomes something else, almost sort of out of boredom to begin with. And there is a kind of there's a kind of anger, and I wonder if you could call it sort of post-Nirvana, sort of, there isn't really a cause to be angry about. So he's just sort of angry with the way his own life has gone. And this is not to justify beating up kids in the street, but I wonder if that is an expression of his own sort of self-loathing.
Well, yeah, and then that, I mean, there must be there's a kind of allegorical dimension of, you know, he's kind of us, as it were, you know, or he's a certain generation or something. Yeah.
Do you want to have a look at that sequence? I thought it would be fun to actually look at something in
Sure.
detail. I just thought the opening of the film, since it's easy to find, up to the point where there's a scene change. So sort of he's in the shop and then he walks home and then there's the squirrel and it falls from the tree. And then maybe when he gets into his flat, we could cut it off there. Great, are you all done?
Beginning is great. The beginning is, I really, watching that again, yeah, if the whole film was as good as that, it would be really, I'm just very, I was actually very taken by that, sort of
But
watching it with a
so
close analysis head on.
it's good to look at these things in detail sometimes. He's in a cafe and there's a long queue, as I'm sure is typical in East LA, for coffee. And on the window, there's the letters, "Beware the dog," and those are being scrubbed off by
Yeah,
waitresses.
and that's the first shot, but we're seeing it from inside, so it's backwards. So we have to decode right at the, it's not the hardest thing to do, but you know, right at
Yes.
the beginning. And there's a sort of joke of, I'm not quite sure what the joke is, but I do find it's kind of funny, because at the end of the film, you go back to the same cafe and the letters are there, they're just like slightly faded, so they've sort of completely failed to scrub them off, which I don't know, I'm not quite sure what's going on there, but I kind of found
Yeah,
that
yeah.
funny.
And
Yes,
then
and there's his
he.
line, and there's a certain kind of hipster. I mean, sort of everyone in there is about 25, aren't they? There's kind of, right, there's quite a sort of homogeneity, not so much of race, but of it feels like, of age and social class.
Yeah, for sure. And then but you get told something important about his character early on, maybe. Or maybe not, maybe you're given the wrong idea. But while queuing for coffee, he's transfixed on one of the counter girls and stares longingly.
when he sees it in the same rate, right? Because he's transfixed by the beware of the dog message, and he turns around and he sort of looks at her in the same, seems like he sees everything in the same, he's kind of permanently distracted but also permanently kind of fixated, which
Yeah, that's
it's almost like it's his music video as well. I quite like, it's not, the beginning is sort of like being in a music video, and then the music does become very kind of Bernard Herrmann. There's some great low strings and all sort of stuff later, but again, it's not as crude as sort of saying, this music is in his head, but it's sort of the emphaticness of the music seems very related to his it's a sort of mismatch with his kind of also slightly blank expression, as well as being sort of he manages to be, it's a really good performance even again in these couple of moments, right? While being obsessively staring, he's also somehow somewhat out of it, somewhat vacuous.
Yes.
So there's a sort of humor in the music, there's a sort of irony in the sort of mismatch of the music that is overinflating, but also it sort of seems to soundtrack his life,
The music that we're describing is quite a mellow rock. It sounds like the Lemonheads or something like that, but I think it might be, it's not the Lemonheads, but it's in that kind of vein in the cafe. And then as soon as he leaves and starts to walk along that woodland path and the sort of woody rural area, the sort of wild areas of Hollywood are cast in a different light. We get the sort of
Yeah,
sort of
absolutely.
mystery, sort of orchestral music coming in.
Yes, I mean, at the very beginning, it could almost be a it could be the beginning of a sort of misfits rom-com, right? It's that, yeah, he's a slightly sort of, even in this social situation, he's slightly sort of, asocial or whatever. And yeah, what do you call it, before the meet cute, when, if there's a thing, when the lovers see each other, or one person spots them for the first time,
Yeah, it's that
it's
kind of
that.
thing.
And then it
And
swiftly
then it
turns
gets
into
weird.
something else.
It does, although it's sort of weird from the beginning because of that beware the dog killer signage, already there you've got the sign of sort of weird lunchy in LA cafe, the kind of thing you might expect to see in Mulholland Drive.
No, it's
And
definitely weird, but it sort of could be sort of quirky weird, couldn't it? It could go, but it could be sort of, ultimately a kind of romance, a kind of rom-com with quirkiness. And then, yeah, but then when the, I think when the squirrel falls from the tree,
he's
you're
walking home through the woods and a squirrel falls from the tree and looks up at him in its last dying moments, as if accusingly or as if to say, the storm is coming.
I think that's, but it's great. Then that's really, because it's funny and it's over the top, but it's sort of intense. There's lots happening. And you've got, there's quite a lot about his character. I mean, you don't know very much, but you sort of get quite a lot, I think, even without having to think about it consciously.
Yeah.
His filthy hair and his.
It's sort of puncturing, and he does this throughout, sort of puncturing that kind of obsessive sort of voyeurism that he has, that kind of masturbatory or weird sexual mindset is being punctured by the sort of weirdness of LA. And then he enters the apartment building, walks along its corridor, and I noticed just this time there is an Amazon Prime package
Oh,
waiting
brilliant.
for
I
his
didn't see
neighbor.
that. Right.
And later on, of course, he flies a drone with his friends. Drone has been bought from Amazon. They're going to try and spy on a lingerie model who, sort of, I suppose, destroys any expectations we had by sort of bursting into tears and making the man feel quite guilty, visibly guilty and awkward.
Well, just all, and that seems to be the sort of condemnatory aspect of that scene, because they don't actually mention it. And yes, maybe there's a slight awkwardness, but then Sam just leaves. Nobody even comments on perhaps we shouldn't be watching now. They just stop watching. So it's, other thing I'd like in this, which, well, this first bit, which reminded me of other things, but in the film, I like, there's sort of subtle, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, but or at least sort of relatively subtle sort of disorientating cinematography. There's things, there's a bit that, like, there's a couple in at the very start when he's looking at Sarah, and the shot of him and her, they have this, it's this sort of dolly in, but with very, very sharp, sort of shallow focus. So like, he so Andrew Garfield and his shot, and then Sarah and her friend on the wall are like very much in focus, and everything else is extremely out of focus. But this doesn't change at all, even though we're moving in, which is slightly weird somehow, right? Normally in that kind of, and then there's a dolly zoom after the squirrel, which is sort of basically Hitchcockian. And there are other things later that I noticed. You know, there are those kind of pans with, I guess it's a, you know, anamorphic lens or something. So the people at the edge of the pan are always a bit weird, you know.
Although the film is quite, seems to be quite loose in its storytelling, we decided it might not. The camera work is very, very technically accomplished. There's a variety of techniques in there. You think of the zooms and the pans and the long takes, and also the camera movement itself. The camera becomes kinetic in one of the nightclubs that they go to. It's playing vintage pop and they're dancing on the floor.
The performances are good. I mean, there's lots of sort of good acting and interesting things going on, but they're not as, I feel like the film wants them to be much more sort of arresting and memorable than they actually are. You know, I feel he's meant to be experiencing a whole bunch of quirky characters, sort of unforgettable, sort of weird, and I'm not sure I would say that it necessarily kind of achieves that. You know, if you compare it to when David Lynch tries to do equivalent things, right? So, you know, think of Lost Highway and think of, you know, like Mr. Eddy, and when he beats up the guy at the side of the road, or the whatever, you know, the pale-faced man is called, and the whole I'm in your house scene. You know, these are the kind of vignettes that this film, I think, is trying to do, right? It's trying to have these, you just meet these weird people, and then they're meant to be sort of unforgettable kind of encounters, and they're just not, for me, not for the most part, just not quite intense enough, or sort of, or just.
Yeah, I suppose it's complicated by the fact that a lot of these characters belong to groups that are trying to fit into the LA scene, in which, you know, it's quite difficult to be unique or difficult to be new, which is part of the sort of rhetoric of the songwriter that he meets as well, that it's all sort of regurgitated. Yeah, it's difficult when you invoke a genre in a place like that. To be supposed to deliver on gravitas. You know, think about the tradition we're talking about is LA Confidential and the Big Lebowski and the Long Goodbye.
And well, it's a noir. No, yeah, that's a really good. It's a noir thing again. Going back to the Big Sleep. You know, the Big Sleep has that again. You have each crook who you meet, or each minor hoodlum, and again in that film, lots of them. Or you know, when he goes into Dorothy Malone's bookshop. You know, she's only in the film for like sort of 4 minutes, but she's unforgettable. You know, it seems to be in invoking that sort of structure, which there is something sort of noirish about. I mean, not that obviously any film can have a memorable performance, but there's something in keeping with, if it is in this, which it is, right, this LA disorientating noir genre, the sort of encounter, the memorable encounter, seems to be quite a important structural element of that.
I think it is because the noir says, you know, there's something in the water, there's something unsettling. The melodrama does it for the home, and the western does it for the Wild West, and noir does it for the sort of city streets. And so everyone doesn't become a suspect, but they become sort of critical. Their characteristics seem somewhat pronounced because they could be involved somehow, and they might be used to the hero. And so. You need good casting, I suppose, and a good script to hold that all together. And I don't think the film is a weak film. I think it's a very good film, but I can see why you might find fault in it as a noir that doesn't quite have that sort of network of mystery. Cool, we should probably wrap it up there because
Let's
I've
wrap it
got.
up.
Thanks for listening to Discursion podcast, and thanks for. rejoining us after a season break. Next episode, we'll continue the neo-noir theme, and we'll be looking at Uncut Gems, the Safdie Brothers 2018 film, moving from Los Angeles then to New York, and a slightly different tradition of noir and elements of crime, thriller, and sort of gang violence. So that'll be really exciting. Do subscribe on Podbean, Spotify, and iTunes. And you can also follow us for updates on Twitter at Discursion Film. Thanks very much for listening, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
See you next time.
Bye. Yeah.
It'll go down like. No. Did you say go down like hotcakes? That sounds like a.
It'll go down like hotcakes. Yeah.
That sounds like I've missed out the metaphor. Is that the phrase?
Welcome to Discursion Podcast, the podcast that goes down like hotcakes.
I guess it goes like hotcakes, isn't it? Well, anyway, maybe we'll innovate with the notion of going down like hotcakes. I have no idea how a hotcake would go down. It would go down any differently from a cold cake, anyway.